Okay, so thanks very much to all of you for being here, and thanks also for hanging in for day number two. So this is sort of a little thought piece on all of the various doctrines in patent law that are meant to mediate multi-party interactions. And it's sort of about the ways in which those doctrines affect the types of licenses and contracts that these parties are going to negotiate given the legal landscape that they face. So it stems from the idea that patent law is kind of fundamentally built around these dyadic relationships. You have one patent holder and one infringer, or maybe you have multiple patent holders and multiple infringers, all of whom are in effectively bilateral relationships to one another. That's kind of the building block of the doctrine. Partly because it's, you know, an old doctrine that comes from days in which that's what the world looked like to a large degree. So the doctrines that exist to handle sort of more complicated multi-party interactions are usually just thought of as offshoots of the more basic doctrines. So we have infringement and we have contributory infringement. Or we have the Section 102B statutory bars, and we have the third-party rules about the Section 102B statutory bars, et cetera. So my object here is to try to think about all of these third-party doctrines kind of as a set, and I should say in fairly abstract fashion, in a preliminary way, and to try to, you know, puzzle out what some of the strengths and weaknesses of those doctrines might be. So I've chosen kind of four to think about. You know, I tried to pick four that I thought were particularly important, but I'm certainly excited to hear about others that I should be writing about or thinking about. Okay, and so obviously I should say, you know, that I'm going to elide some important details in the presentation. I'm happy to talk about them more in Q&A. So start with contributory infringement. So we imagine we have a sort of simple arrangement here. You have a patent holder, and then on the other side we have a vertical supply chain, a couple of suppliers going up to a producer. And when I say a producer, the producer is basically just the direct infringer. So this could be the person who fires up Microsoft Windows and then clicks on the right programs to activate the function that violates the patent. It need not actually be a person producing a solid good. So the rule of contributory infringement, of course, is that these suppliers are also liable for infringement if they are producing goods or processes that are a substantial part of what's resulting in the direct infringement, if they don't have any substantial non-infringing uses, and if they have full knowledge of they have knowledge not only of the existence of the patent, but also of the fact that the producer doesn't have a license for it. Scott, sure.
Analysis change in any way if we call the person you're calling producer customer?
Customer of whom? Of the patent holder or of the suppliers?
At least the suppliers.
No change if we're talking about the suppliers. I mean, what I'm going to talk about is what happens when the producer and the patent holder don't know each other and aren't in contact and so forth. But yeah, I don't. These are just labels. I don't care who the producer is exactly. Okay, so that's the basic rules of contributory infringement. Now, when the producer is available and solvent and can be reached by suit, everything works very nicely. We sort of don't need the rules of contributory infringement in some sense. This producer knows that it's liable to the patent holder, knows that it's liable for all infringing conduct. And so among other things, this producer has an incentive to go out and find the patent holder and negotiate a license before taking infringing actions, just as the patent holder might have an incentive to find the producer. Now, of course, Mark and Becky and others have pointed out these producer types do not always go out and search for patents, but certainly a lot of them are doing so. So what this means, because of the producer's liability, these parties in the supply network have an incentive to essentially allocate the costs of this search for the patent up and down the supply chain. So it might be that, in fact, supplier number one is better positioned to figure out whether there are patents, or at least patents in a certain field. The producer can contract with supplier number one and arrange that. So all these parties have these incentives to engage in search. They can distribute those search costs to the lowest cost searcher. And the patent holder also has some incentive to search. There's sort of a mixed strategy equilibrium that's going to be reached here, where each party engages in some but not perfect search. And that's the whole story. Here's what these search costs are going to be. Now, the idea is that, by and large, searching on the part of the producer and the suppliers is going to be cheaper and more efficient than searching by the patent holder. First of all, there are simply more parties who can allocate the search costs among themselves so they can find out who the more efficient actor is. And secondly, by and large, these patents are going to be easier to find than the products that might infringe. The patents are searchable, the patents are indexed. The products not only are searchable and indexed, but also do not always reveal their contents on their face and have to be examined. So this is a nice system when we've got these parties with significant incentives to engage in search, because they're probably the parties we want to be doing as much of the search as possible. So now the question is, what happens when the producer becomes unavailable for suit or insolvent or otherwise not amenable to be sort of hailed into court? And I'm representing this with these dashed lines. So in that case, we have this possibility of contributory infringement lawsuits against the suppliers. And I think that's the rationale for contributory infringement. But of course, there's a big barrier to it within the doctrine, which is this requirement of knowledge. These parties have to know of the patent, and they have to know of the non-existence of a license as well. So the equilibrium now changes. So these parties no longer have an incentive to search. Of course, in fact, they have an incentive to avoid searching. And what that means is it forces the patent holder to become the primary searching agent. It has to invest all the necessary efforts in finding these suppliers and finding the producer. And even in circumstances where this producer is not insolvent, there will be feedback effects. The patent holders out there in the world don't know how many insolvent producers there are, so they don't know how many of these sorts of supply chains will or will not have incentives to go out and look for them, to look for their patents. And so they have to increase their search activities, increase their expenditures on their comparatively inefficient search in order to find these parties. And so the problem is that this knowledge requirement sort of breaks the incentives on this side of the horizontal relationship to allocate and negotiate search costs up and down. Richard.
Yeah, the question I have is, you call supplier one a contributory infringer, but given the description you make that he's the guy who knows more, is there at least not a possibility that what happens is supplier number one is actually a direct infringer, takes some of these products, incorporates it into its components, and shifts it up to the producer, so that you're not always going to have the kind of asymmetries that you talked about in the reasons you mentioned?
Absolutely. Supplier number certainly could be a direct infringer in a lot of cases. There might be a set of patents for which supplier number one is the direct infringer, but also a set of patents for which supplier number one is merely a contributory infringer. Right, but a lot of these cases, there are, you know, a lot of these circumstances where supplier number one might be the knowledgeable big party, you know, Microsoft or an Apple or something like that, but they're still not directly infringing until they've sold something to a user and that user has taken a particular type of action. That's kind of a canonical contributory infringement case. So that's the problem with the doctrine. And of course, it's generated by this knowledge requirement, which is sort of an outlier in all the law. You basically never see in any other area of law requirement that someone know of the non-existence of a license and know of the status of a property right before they're held to be a violation of some rule. And of course, the other problem is not only do these parties have no incentive to search because they're not liable, the liability is not retroactive. Even if they become aware of the patent, the liability is not retroactive back to their point of ignorance. And so they can go ahead blithely doing whatever they want to up until the point when they become aware of what's going on. So I think this is just a quick summary. So we get this distortion to the search equilibrium. We have this excessive search on the part of the patent holder, which we're trying to avoid. And then, of course, in addition, there's this problem of uncompensated infringement. The patent holder is not getting paid for the infringing activity that took place before these contributory infringers learned of the existence of the patent. Now, again, we don't know. I mean, I'm not trying to apply any sort of great normative judgments. Maybe this is a good thing. Maybe this is a bad thing. But if we're trying to, raise and lower the amount of damages that infringers are paying to patent holders, this is probably not the most adept way of doing it. So I just want to sort of posit another possibility, which is moving to a negligence standard instead of this knowledge standard. So if we require these suppliers to make reasonable efforts to find the patent, all of a sudden what we've done now is we've linked them back into the patent holder directly in a way that this sort of knowledge requirement doesn't. We've allowed the patent holder to access other points along the supply chain. And our search problems disappear because now all of these people still have incentives to engage in search and to try to acquire the relevant knowledge where they wouldn't have before. Now, of course, the reason why we have a knowledge requirement in contributory infringement is because there's this fear that everything becomes contributory infringement without it. I think that's, not an unreasonable fear, but it's, there's a second half to this doctrine, which is that the good you're manufacturing has to lack any substantial non-infringing uses. So if you really have a party making a specialized good whose only purpose is to perform one function, and that one function happens to infringe a patent, it's not clear that you couldn't sort of evade this problem in other ways simply through that piece of the doctrine. Those people maybe should be held liable regardless, and we shouldn't worry too much. So it's, in any case, I'm not clear that this is, this might have other negative effects in other domains. The point is just to explore what happens if we moved to a negligence regime instead of this sort of outlier knowledge standard. Okay, so that's contributory infringement. Next, and I'll maybe move a little faster, sort of quick point about non-mutual offensive issue preclusion. So these are rules that are common to all areas of law, not just patent law. And the idea naturally is that if I have a patent and Omri sues me, if the court declares my patent invalid in that lawsuit, it's invalid against every other subsequent party who I might engage in litigation with. On the other hand, if I win and my patent is held to be valid as against Omri, nonetheless, Randy can come along the next week and sit and challenge my patent again and have another shot at trying to invalidate it. So this is obviously important in a lot of areas of law. It's particularly important in the patent law because of the nature of patent remedies and because of the metamune rule that people who take licenses of patents can discontinue paying royalties on those licenses if the patent is later invalidated. And I should say again, I'm not at all trying to defend the metamune rule. I'm just sort of looking at its interaction with these non-mutual offensive issue preclusion doctrines. Right, so in patent law, we have a lot of running royalties and ongoing payments, and we have the possibility of cutting them off if, in fact, the patent is later declared invalid. So in sort of standard models of this, what you might see are sequential suits against the patent holder, possible. So patent holder against infringer number one, patent holder against infringer number two, and then infringer number three. That's not what we want for a couple of reasons, the primary one being it's just a big transaction cost sink. So what we'd much rather have is the patent holder just sort of suing everyone simultaneously and these parties all kind of, you know, collaborating in a common defense against the patent holder. One big litigation to decide everything. Lower transaction costs and more likely the correct outcome. Now, that's the socially sort of optimal result. That's not the result that's in the interest of these infringers. What the infringers want to do is strike a deal to sequentially attack the patent and hope to take advantage of the metamune rule and the rules about non-mutual issue preclusion. So they cut an arrangement amongst themselves, and infringer number one starts out with a lawsuit, and if that fails, infringer number two, and then infringer number three. So this is bad for a couple of reasons. So number one, you've got the sort of multiple roll of the dice problem. You're going to lead to more chances to invalidate the patent and an artificially higher likelihood that it'll be undone. And you also, of course, have these higher transaction costs. We have sequential or possibly simultaneous attacks on the same patent by different parties in different litigations. Now, there are obviously barriers to these sorts of arrangements. And so that's sort of the point of this, is to look at what the barriers are. Well, if these parties were really in some sort of contractual deal to engage in, in this behavior, the court's going to declare you're all in privity, you're all bound, that's the end of the story. So that's fine and good. The problem with that, of course, is that it's not as a deterrent mechanism, that doesn't really have a lot of punch, because all that the parties are losing is the ability to engage in these sorts of shenanigans. They're not being penalized at all for trying and failing in some sense. They're no worse off than they were if they were.
Yeah. How do they set it up if they are infringers, which suggests to me that they are infringing now?
Yeah.
How do they set it up that the patent holder sues them seriatim, rather than just suing them all at the same
time? They would all take licenses from the patent holder and then file for declaratory judgment actions one after the other.
Or it just happens. I mean,
yeah.
Oddly, right, lots of people file lots of different lawsuits rather than consolidate.
Yeah.
Again, jurisdictional issues.
Right. So the point is somehow that the remedy for this sort of attempted behavior is no worse than the status quo point of what we would sort of want the patent holder to be doing and want in a, you know, perfect optimal world. So as a remedial measure, patent law doesn't necessarily do a great job of offering a strong deterrent against this sort of behavior. It's, by the way, it's worth noting. Sorry?
Yeah, this is the famous problem in all offensive use.
Not clear it's worse than any other field, but offensive non-mutual issue preclusion is more important in patent law. And so therefore, if this is a problem anywhere, it's a much bigger problem in the world of patents. Okay, just sort of two more, even shorter. Okay, so rules of patent exhaustion, the well-known Quanta case. Okay, so the usual rule, of course, is that if you're a patent holder and you sell to initial purchaser, your patent rights are exhausted. You have no rights against a third-party purchaser to whom the initial purchaser might later sell the good. So that's what Quanta says. Quanta says this link does not exist as a matter of patent law. Now, of course, it sort of appears as if the patent holder can simply write a contract with the initial purchaser to bind the initial purchaser from selling to this third party later on down the road. I think it's, you know, the case is a little unclear on that point, and people are fighting about this. I happen to think that that is what Quanta says, but you know, if that's not what it says, there are even a whole host of different and greater problems. Okay, so what to make of this replacement of the patent remedy with a contract remedy? So first and foremost, obviously, we have a move from a property rule to a liability rule. Obviously, now the property rule and patent is not perfect because eBay says you don't always get the injunctions. But nonetheless, you're probably much more likely to get them in the contractual case. And in these contractual cases, it might be difficult to prove damages under a lot of circumstances. What are the damages that the patent holder can collect because this initial purchaser has sold to some third party that the patent holder doesn't like, didn't want the good to go to in the first place? It's hard to know and hard to anticipate. Hard to know whether courts are going to enforce liquidated damages clauses. Hard to know whether courts will actually enforce injunctions in some of these contract cases. So that's sort of the first order problem, is this replacement. So the second order problem gets back a little bit to the contributory infringement situation. And the question is, what happens when our initial purchaser is no longer solvent or available for suit in some fashion? Now, the whole problem here, of course, is that the patent holder can't reach the third-party purchaser by patent law and can't reach it by contract law either, because the third-party purchaser is not in contractual privity with the patent holder. So the initial purchaser is our only link in the chain, just as the producer is the only link in the chain in the contributory infringement sense. So when this initial purchaser becomes not a target for a lawsuit, the whole mechanism for the patent holder starts to unwind. And again, I'll issue my standard disclaimer. I don't mean to defend or attack the Quanta rule. I don't know if it's a good or a bad rule. I'm just talking about methods of subversion given the contours of Quanta. So now, of course, the patent holder is in a somewhat better situation here because the patent holder is contracting with this initial purchaser. So the patent holder can know what that party's finances are. Also, this person is presumably getting money from this sale, so that money is disgorgeable to the patent holder in some fashion. But nonetheless, it creates all sorts of monitoring costs that don't necessarily exist in these circumstances. So if you're the patent holder and you're making this sale, by and large, all you should care about is whether the person has the money to pay you for the license that they're taking out or for the good that they're purchasing. Now, all of a sudden, you might want to think about whether they're going to have the money to pay a judgment somewhere down the road, or whether they're going to, you know, remain available in your jurisdiction, or all sorts of other things like that. It forces these contracts to have continuing, it forces these patent holders to pay continuing attention to the contracts in a way that they wouldn't necessarily want to if they're just trying to engage in a series of one-off sales. So again, the fact of this sort of breaking of the linkage forces all sorts of transaction costs, you know, in this case, monitoring costs, maybe not search costs, on top of the patent holder that didn't necessarily exist before, that the patent holder might not be interested in trying to bear. And finally, I think I said all this already. So the Section 102B rules on sales and public uses of patented inventions. So Section 102B of the Patent Act, of course, says if you put something on sale more than a year before you file for a patent, nobody gets a patent on it. But this is a rule that's meant to prevent commercial exploitation by the patent holder. You don't get to sell something for some number of years and then file for a patent for it. So third-party sales don't trigger the on-sale bar. Some other company sells the good. If I then file for a patent later, I'm in the clear. Then we have next to it the public use bar. Public use bar seems to be geared towards preventing the taking of knowledge away from the public domain. If the public learns of an invention, then you can no longer file for a patent on it afterwards if it's been a year since the public gained this information. But of course, this doesn't apply to non-informing public uses. So if there's an invention that's out there in the world and it doesn't tell anyone about how to make it or use it, then public use bar is not triggered. So the result of this in combination is that non-informing third-party sales do not seem to trigger Section 102B bars. So that means suppose you've got an invention which is a machine for manufacturing something, and you go out there and you sell that thing, if I couldn't learn how to make your machine from looking at the thing itself, which might be fairly common, then later on I can go and get a patent on the same thing, irrespective of the Section 102B bars. Okay, so now we've got this rule about third parties engaged in non-informing uses. Okay, so the standard situation, yeah, go ahead.
You're using a machine though commercially though, right? You're using a machine commercially, selling a product, you're using a machine for more than a year.
Exactly. If you're,
but, you can't file.
Exactly. I'm commercially exploiting. It's when you're using the machine and then I want to file later on.
So that distinction is correct, right? We do in fact treat public use different.
Yeah.
I don't think you're right to say we treat on sale bar differently. Like a third party sale of product more than a year before you file your patent application is a bar.
A third party non-informing use?
A sale?
I don't agree with that. I don't think that's right. We can talk about that more. I mean, there isn't a ton of case law on this. I think that's not what Gore says.
Gore's a use case.
Well, but why wouldn't it have triggered?
It could have been a case too, right?
Yeah.
You said you were selling it internally.
Yeah, but the point is
you're selling the product of it.
Exactly.
But it was a process claim. The patent claim that you're using is you're using only internally inside the thing, where you are selling a product out into the world. More than a year before the patent is filed. It doesn't matter whether it's the inside of a safe in Hull versus McNeil and no one can see what it is. It is still an on-sale box.
Okay, I think I agree with that conclusion, but for different reasons. But the thing is, that's fine. I mean, if what I should be saying here is a process instead, that's perfectly fine. But the bottom line is if a third party is using a process to manufacture something and commercially exploiting that process, that doesn't apply to me. That's fine. Okay, I think we might be completely agree. It's just a matter of defining what the scope of the rule is with regard to inventions. Okay, so standard situation, we have a third-party producer selling to the public, and we have the patent holder being, you know, left out in the cold or whatever. So, of course, the first possibility is the patent holder pays the third-party producer not to sell to the public. Now, that probably violates antitrust laws, assuming this third-party producer is actually a competitor in the marketplace. But if that third-party producer is not, in fact, some reasonable competitor, you know, I don't know, maybe this sort of skates through.
And so, product is an antitrust violation?
Well, if you're just paying someone to stay out of your marketplace, I would imagine that's an antitrust violation.
Unless you're in the pharmaceutical industry.
Right, in which case, it's perfectly... Well, that's exactly the point, is these rules break down a little bit when we move into litigation situations and we move into these patent contexts, right? So it's a little hard to know exactly what the rules will be, especially if this third party, you know, a lot of these on sale cases, the third party producer is not actually a competitor. They're just someone who happens to have prototypes and they're selling a prototype here or a prototype there. So probably this is not allowable, but, you know, hard to know, right? The even more nefarious possibility, I suppose, is the patent holder has a secret licensing deal with the third-party producer. Third-party producer is selling to the public and earning money and kicking it back to the patent holder through some means or other. So, of course, that's probably not good, and if the court catches the patent holder, there's going to be trouble for the patent holder. But again, the question is to look at the remedy. So what's going on here, right? So the license that's occurred, the effective license between the patent holder and the third-party producer that's leading to these sales, there's nothing illegal about that. The illegality comes when the patent holder then later tries to file for a patent despite having engaged in these sort of licensing deals, effectively engaged in commercial exploitation. So it might be fraud on the patent, probably is fraud on the patent office. It's not clear that it's an antitrust violation or fraud in any other sense, so the remedy is probably just the denial of the patent to the patent holder. Now, my sense is that this sort of activity probably happens very, very rarely, if at all, if ever, because what you're gaining are out years on your patent term. You're getting 24 years and 20 instead of 20 years, and the circumstances in which that's valuable to the patent holder are probably few and far between. But nonetheless, the point is that here's a situation of sort of potentially deliberate misconduct to evade a set of patent rules, and we don't have all of our standard fraud remedies and treble damages and all of that stuff. What we've got at the end is just the denial of the patent itself. Okay, so very quickly to conclude. So it sort of seems like these patent rules all work very well when all of the key apex parties are available for suit and they're all solvent. But when that doesn't happen, opportunities for mischief arise. And the problem, of course, is that it's exactly when the central parties are not available that we'd want the third-party rules to function effectively well. And secondly, in a lot of these circumstances, the remedies for collusion just don't necessarily seem to be as robust as we might want them to be. So there's been a lot of good discussion in the last couple days about whether we want patent rules to be about deterrence or not, whether we want them to sort of to achieve deterrence or not. Here, these are intentional misconduct cases by and large. So if we believe in there should be anything deterred, probably these sorts of cases. But they don't necessarily trigger the fraud and, you know, the treble damages provisions and the fraud provisions that we might want this sort of conduct to create in normal circumstances. Okay, I am done. Mark.
On that last point, right, about sort of intentional conduct, I mean, sort of there's an oddity here, right, in that your proposed solution on the contributory infringement side is to get rid of that intent. Right. It seems odd on the one hand to say, well, gosh, we need we need better remedies to deter bad behavior. At the same time, we're going to get rid of the intent requirement.
Yeah.
My worry on that is you make a statement, well, we're fine, we're protected because of the kind of no substantial non-infringing use.
Yeah.
Once you get rid of the intent requirement, how do I know whether any product I sell has a substantial non-infringing use? Right? I don't know what patents are out there. The only way to know is to go out and search all of the patents, conduct a case analysis, and figure out whether or not any of them, in fact, cover the primary market for my product.
Completely agree. I think that's very fair, and I completely agree. I mean, the only point I was trying to make is that if you do not have substantial non-infringing uses for your product, you start to look a lot like a direct infringer in every meaningful sense. And so, you know, you probably know what people are, you know, assuming you reasonably know how people are going to use your product and become actual direct infringers, it's not clear what rationale there is for distinguishing you from the genuine direct infringer, because all you're doing, the only thing that your product is doing, is making something that will infringe down the line. So, I mean, I agree, it's not a complete solution. All I'm saying is it's a way of thinking about this problem in which it doesn't make it seem so outrageous that these contributory infringers who do not necessarily have knowledge are nonetheless being held liable.
I think it's fair. And on the inducement side, right, I mean, I've argued that there ought to be a relationship
between
how involved you are and the level of culpability that's required. But I worry a little, I mean, when you are making things which are by definition in the public domain, not themselves covered by a patent,
right?
Then it seems to me you want there to be something more than just that before you hold someone liable for the selling of something in the public domain, right? So the Dawson Chemical case, propanil, right? I manufacture the chemical propanil. It's a chemical, it's been around for 100 years, it's in the public domain. It turns out that someone's now patented a use for propanil, which is the only use people are making. In that circumstance, I'm making it because I'm selling it to those people. But if I wasn't, right? If I'm just making a chemical which has been lawful to make for 80 years until suddenly there's a patent on a use for it, it seems a little odd to say we can get rid of the intent requirement.
Well, okay, you still have a negligence. I mean, I'm not proposing moving anywhere further than a negligence requirement, right? Which is still more than patent law requires
But I take it that's a search requirement. That is, I take it I now have to know and go out and know again every month or every 6 months or whatever, right, whether there are new patents which affect my ability to continue to manufacture something that was lawful for me to manufacture last year.
Not necessarily. All you have to know is that there are people, a substantial number of people using your product in unpatented ways or public domain sort of ways. And that doesn't seem like an enormous use requirement, because then you're protected and you're in the safe harbor for contributory infringement.
Once the patent issues, right? So they were using, it was perfectly legal to use it until this patent that sat in the patent office for 6 years issued, and now it's not. I don't know that.
Well, okay, but I mean, you've got a subset of people engaging in an activity, you know, using your chemical in a certain way. You check it today and it says public domain, no problem with it. You don't have to go out and learn about every new, you know, so you just have to make sure that that particular activity is still continuing and that those people are still, you're absolutely right. I mean, this is, you know, imposing a search requirement here. You know, it's probably a more efficient search requirement than the ones imposed on the patent holder in the absence of this rule. So if the argument is that it shouldn't exist, it's got to be an argument based on the fact that these contributory infringers are somehow blameless for their activity. I don't think that's a crazy rule. I'm just playing with the possibility of moving in other directions. I'm not sure. You know, a negligence standard still requires something on them. So, yeah, Scott.
So it's a great paper in tying together a number of kind of tricky things, you know, so that's important. If I could just kind of, I'm a little bit nervous about the effort to tie them together, because they may not in fact tie together so well. So, for example, the prior art discussion, we were all debating what you were talking with our apologies. I think in part you're pinching off one of the arguments and then you're saying it kind of doesn't work. But that's because the law in that area is unapologetic about having a plurality of concerns it's trying to address. One of them is patentees extending their patent term, but another one is third-party reliance. And the third-party reliance happens in the setting that you highlighted as kind of inconsistent. And so you want to kind of bake that in, and you probably kind of have that in your mind, but that's kind of a qualitatively different thing. And so then on the other first two sections of your paper, or at least the first, and I forget what the number, but the discussion about contributory infringement, you're having in isolation from the discussion that's not in your paper of inducement. Mm-hmm. And yet, those doctrines, absolutely, they can't exist without each other. Because the paradigmatic case of the first kind of contributory infringement case, the LAMP case, is one where you know you have a high degree of confidence that the seller is simply removing one of the elements to avoid infringement. And the court says, okay, but now you have to sue all the customers, we're sympathetic, we'll let you. But then the law evolves and it recognizes that contributory infringement needs safe harbors. Mm-hmm. It's got these safe harbors, you're talking about them. Mm-hmm. But as we saw in the Grokster case, it's easy to avoid those safe harbors and still be kind of a bad person, and that's in a setting where you've got a lot of intent, and that's why 271B exists, which is to capture cases where you've got a lot of intent, but you don't have, so you have to kind of, I think, have the inducement discussion in any discussion of the contributory.
Okay, so great. I think, let me say two things about that. So number one, you're absolutely right. I need to spend more time talking about inducement. This is, you know, something that certainly would be included. I think I did a sort of an inadequate job of framing exactly what this is meant to be about, right? So I don't mean these as kind of full-throated criticisms of these doctrines, right? As you point out, I'm absolutely not trying to weigh these sorts of issues that I'm describing here against all of the other sorts of merits to the doctrines, generally speaking. I'm not saying a word about all the reasons why we have third-party exceptions to the 102B bars and things like that. Right? That's not absolutely not the point. I think that would be a project beyond the word limit, et cetera. All I'm trying to do is say that these third-party doctrines, which are attempts to make these weighing decisions, have within them kind of a common set of sort of logical aims and also kind of a common set of loopholes. And the point is just to show that in an effort to balance these separate considerations, you might say, look, what people are trying to achieve in contributory infringement and what they're trying to achieve in the 102B statutory bars are completely different objectives. And my point is simply that in attempting to accommodate those completely different objectives, we've nonetheless come up with a set of rules that raise similar sorts of problems of loopholes and evasion, and that we might want to think about why those loophole problems arise, if they in fact are all prevalent in the world, what is the relevance of them, and how we might want to cure them. So I don't want any of this to be taken as an attack on any of those doctrines directly, although I quite understand that that's the way it reads in a lot of respects. I mean it really only as an exploration of the common ways that the problems arise. And that was my whole point at the beginning about saying we usually think of third-party rules as offshoots of their primary doctrines, and we think about them in terms of all of the reasons why the third-party rules exist. I want to try to think of them as a whole set of third-party kind of third-party patent doctrines more generally that give rise to similar sorts of concerns in different domains. Does that make sense at all? Sure.
I think that there's an immense amount of legislative history on exactly what you're talking about with relation to several of the doctrines you're talking about, because they were the major motivators for the 52F, for 271.
Yeah.
So like it's exactly that plurality of, so you'll see that in the, it's there.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. I've looked at quite a lot of that. I mean, I think that, so certainly with regard to some of these doctrines, you know, the 102B rules are judge made by and large. The 271 is where the majority of the legislative history exists. I think that when I read the legislative history, what I think is these legislators understood the problem and walked down the road to a certain degree, but not necessarily all of the way. And in fact, that they didn't sort of fully understand all of the various combinations of possibilities that remained open in that sense. But that's exactly sort of the point that I'm trying to get at here.
Well, yeah, at least those will link all of your antitrust misuse, for sale, exhaustion with your inducement and contributory infringement.
Right, great, absolutely, thank you. Yeah, Richard.
If you go back to the first diagram on contributory infringement, one of the things that you're doing is almost making it simpler than it really is. What you do is you have a single supply chain coming into the sort of ultimate producer. and you just start thinking, well, we should have that. But I thought that one of the problems that one had with the whole contributory infringement doctrine is that instead of having one chain with two people in it, you have 100 chains with 10 people in them each, and that if you don't have the knowledge requirement, that anybody who sold you anything in some sense or another would then become involved in this particular situation. And that the reason why the knowledge requirement works or is so seems to be so much embedded into it is it's the only way that you can reduce yourself to the fact that you're now worrying about a single chain, you know, the one unique input and so forth. And the, as I mentioned to you in that little note I gave you, this is of course exactly the same problem that you have in all the criminal law stuff where you do exactly the same thing. Somebody's going to commit a burglary, and the hardware store sells them the screwdriver. Now, generally speaking, you sell screwdrivers to all sorts of people for all sorts of reasons, and either you have a knowledge requirement that he's going to be engaged in the burglary, or in effect, that burglar who assembles, you know, equipment from 27 different suppliers is going to find that each and every one of them may now find themselves into serious trouble. And so I'm just curious as to why, whether or not you think it might be appropriate for you, sort of a variation of the Scott paper, is to sort of at least somewhere along the line sort of acknowledge the motivations for the creation of the doctrine so that, you know, this then becomes a liability with an asset as opposed to just being an anomaly without a purpose.
Okay. I do think I acknowledge it. I at least had gone that far. I mean, I take the point. I think, you know, based on what you and Mark are saying, I mean, maybe I should just sort of let go this notion of a negligence standard instead. And maybe that's the thing to do. You know, I guess if all I'm doing is showing that the consequence of moving to this sort of a rule is that we've heightened search costs in certain domains, you know, maybe I should rest on that. I mean, I think that if what we're doing is, I mean, if the rule is just merely an allocation of search costs across this horizontal relationship, I think it's still worth thinking about whether we might want to impose it even on someone who's been manufacturing something that's in the public domain. But I take the point. It might be that, in fact, there are other contributory cost reasons on the other side.
I mean, it's a little bit like the same comment we made about Florenzi's paper at the beginning of the day, which is, this is an analysis searching for a problem or a problem that's searching for an analysis? And what I mean by that is you actually sort of go out into the world and consult, you know, the people here who do this. Is contributory infringement the kind of issue which they regard as a sore point? And so that you get industry pressures on the doctrine from one side or another, either inadequate relief or excessive relief. I mean, you know, I don't spend all my time trolling in these waters. I'm sorry, you're still wrong. trawling in these waters. Not trolling. But I don't get the sense that there is any sort of widespread discontentment with this particular area, which hasn't come up with some fix. And the one area I'm thinking about was that there's all these anomalies with the sellers of tools to surgeons, and what they did is they created the exceptions for the surgeons, right, from the liability when they were the direct infringers in order to get the contributory infringers. Mm-hmm. And the reason they did that, of course, is it's a completely different graph from this one. That's a situation where the producers were doing the thing, the direct infringers, there were hundreds of them, and there was only one contributory infringer, that is the seller. And the innocence, I mean, you're talking about the knowledge case, it was in exactly the opposite direction. And there you got a statutory fix. Oh, I'm not mistaken. Did you? I think.
Okay. Yeah, I mean,
it's
an open question how big a problem this is, how much it goes on. I mean, I do get the sense whenever I haven't talked to or have anything to do with people who are in the business of filing contributory infringement lawsuits that they don't like the fact that direct infringers are unavailable in various contexts and that they are upset about the amount of searching and effort that's required to find the proper contributory infringer whom they can actually sue. You know, again, I don't mean anything necessarily normative by that. I'm not trying to say that, you know, we ought to make it life easier for them. But it is true that there are, you know, I do think that there are, at least in that domain, search costs that are higher than they necessarily they ought to be.
What I was saying is if you added the multiple chains, the reason that the concern is, in the case you've done, mm-hmm. is that you've got lots of contributory infringers in a single producer. The search in cases is the paradox. We have a single contributory infringer and lots of producers. So this is a time at which actually the focal point on the indirect infringer is the one that makes economics.
Okay, that's a good point. Thank you. Mark, yes?
I mean, the search cost point is a fair one, though. It seems to me worth thinking about, in each of your examples, how it would couple with a kind of least cost avoider story.
Yeah.
Right? So easiest one, it seems to me, is the public use prior art piece, mm-hmm. right? Because the least cost avoider in this case is the patent applicant who just has to file the thing within a bloody year.
Yeah.
Right? So we could actually worry a lot about modulating
creating a rule collusion and sort of thing, or they could just file in a year. To me, contributory infringement is also in that category. That is, we could impose a search cost on everybody who makes a product to go out and make sure every month that it's not, in fact, being used primarily for this infringing purpose, right? Or we could have the patent owner who wants to enforce the patent figure out who's making the inputs into the suppliers. And be, precisely because those are concentrated people, I think the search is substantially easier there.
Okay.
It gets a little harder, I think, in the case of an offensive non-mutual collateral estoppel.
Yeah.
So again, you might think the first order response is patentee can solve this problem. All they can do is sue all three of these people in one court. And in fact, they often do. There are some limitations on your ability to do that. That is, they might have come around later. Some judges won't accept defendants who are linked only by the fact that they infringe the same patent as co-defendants in the same case. Maybe you can't get personal jurisdiction over some of them.
They might have taken out licenses already.
Right, but then, so that would then allow you in sort of thinking about kind of how, what links and also doesn't link these things together, right? You can sort of think about whether or not the law needs to move as a virtue not just of here are cases with search costs, but what's the most efficient response to those search costs?
Yeah, no, I completely agree. I mean, I think in the vast majority of these situations, I think entirely in agreement with you on who the least cost avoider is, you know, especially when it comes to the 102B section, and especially when it comes to the non-mutual issue preclusion context. The point there, I think, is merely that the sanctions on the least cost avoider might not be high enough to force that person to take the cost avoiding measures. The contributory infringement is a more open question. I don't know exactly who the best searcher is here, who the lowest cost are, and I have an intuition about that based on the availability of patents. You know, it sounds like you and Richard have maybe contrary intuitions. So I think that I have to think about that in both directions. Completely agree. But I think that the framework I'm trying to impose on it is essentially identical to the one that you're describing here. So I appreciate that. Thank you.
Do we have more questions?
Yeah, Mark. But just to follow up on Mark's point, I wasn't sure what the problem was with the propanol example and the chemical compound, because it's been in the public domain for 8 years. It probably has a lot of different uses that are out there. And usually when you're filing a new process patent on a known compound, you're not going to be filing a new use on the propanol alone. It's usually going to be propanol in combination with maybe a nitrogen source, a carrier, and a solvent, and maybe combined with another compound, assuming that that's even not obvious as well. So I don't think it's a real problem on the issues contributory infringement problems.
Yeah, I don't know. I feel like I should let Mark respond. But I mean, I don't know, right? So I think the situation that Mark is describing is one which that new use develops and all of a sudden everyone's making use of it only in that fashion and not in any other way. And
or so a new use develops or a patent suddenly appears, right? So I'm selling a product, right? And it's legal for me to sell that product until 5 years from now you get a patent that covers the dominant use of that product. Right, which means that I've got not only to search and see what those dominant users are doing now, but I've got to then go continue to search to make sure that that's no longer something that someone could later allege to fit within the scope of their patent.
Absolutely. No, I'm completely in agreement on that, right? It's just a question of, it's an empirical question of how frequently those situations arise. I don't know. My situation, my sense is rarely, but who knows?
We're going to stop this before.